Good day. Today's Friday, 31st October 2025. And let me remind you again, before I get into the details of this video, to tick the like button if once you've watched or listened to the video or whatever part of the video you want to watch and listen to, you like what you've heard and wish to indicate that fact. Now, at the start of this programme, I am going to return to the topic of the meeting between President Xi Jinping of China and President Donald Trump of the United States, because over the last couple of hours since I made my previous video, more information has come to light about the nature of the agreements reached between the United States and China. And in addition, they have been explanations have been provided of these agreements by people I would certainly consider experts in this matter, people like Kathleen Tyson and, of course, Arnaud Bertrand. And I'm going to revise somewhat what I said in my programme yesterday. I said that it seemed to me that the Americans and the Chinese had agreed a one-year truce, which already looked to me a one-year truce in their trade conflict, which already seemed to me a win for China. It clearly goes a lot further than that. And I'm going to say it straightforwardly. It seems to me that Xi Jinping and China just wiped the floor on Scott Bessent and Donald Trump. It's one of the most, well, in fact, as far as I can see, it is the most conclusive defeat in trade negotiations that I have seen in any negotiations entered into by the United States in my lifetime. And obviously, this is not something that is being much spoken about in the West, but I think that over the next couple of weeks and months, probably the full implications of what has happened will begin to percolate through. Well, I'm going to focus on what Arnaud Bertrand has said, and he has provided a very long message, a very long post on X, in which he sets out in detail the nature of the agreement and in which he explains it thoroughly. And I will go through Arnaud Bertrand's post. Let me begin. He says the key terms. One, the United States will remove the so-called 50% rule that it implemented in September for 1 year, in exchange for which China will suspend its rare earths export controls for 1 year. Now, to clarify what Arnaud Bertrand is talking about, the 50% rule has been explained recently in an article by Reuters. It was a rule unveiled by the Trump administration on September 29th, and it barred Chinese firms at least 50% owned by previously sanctioned companies from receiving US tech exports. The measure purportedly was intended to prevent Chinese firms that had been sanctioned from using subsidiaries to buy restricted technology. In fact, it hit 20,000 Chinese companies with export restrictions. Anyway, now returning to what Arnaud Bertrand says, the removal of the 50% rule is absolutely key, yet almost no media is reporting it, only mentioning that China had agreed to suspend its rare earths exports controls for 1 year. And Bartrand then mentions that none other, no less a person than Scott Bessent himself confirmed that the United States is indeed suspending for 1 year the 50% rule. And then Arnaud Bertrand continues, the 50% rule was the main reason why China retaliated with the rare earths export controls. It was a huge escalation by the United States, increasing the number of Chinese companies on the entity list, that is to say the sanctions list, by 14 times, from 1,400 companies to 20,000. Meaning 14 times more Chinese companies were cut off from the Western financial system, forbidden to use the dollar, etc. And then he says something which I find quite interesting. It is the key to understanding the Nexperia debacle. The 50% rule would have put Nexperia on the sanctions list, the entity list, and the United States told the Dutch that the only way Nexperia could escape US sanctions was to get rid of Chinese ownership in the company. The Dutch therefore moved to seize the company away from Chinese ownership almost simultaneously with the introduction of the 50% rule. And Bertrand speculates whether, now that the rule has been suspended for a year, the Dutch will return Expedia to its actual Chinese owners. Well, there's a number of points to make about this. I have no doubt at all that Arnaud Bertrand is right, that it was indeed this massive expansion of the sanctions list which took place in September, shortly after the Madrid trade truce was agreed, and that must have infuriated the Chinese intensely. I mean, increasing the number of Chinese companies 14-fold, the number of sanctioned Chinese 14-fold, would have been almost guaranteed to provoke a strong reaction from China, and of course that is precisely what it did. But I'm going to make one further observation, which goes back to what Arnaud Bertrand says about China agreeing to suspend for 1 year the operation of its restrictions on exports of rare earths. Kathleen Tyson, by the way, is saying the same thing. Now, yesterday, when I looked at the statement that had been published by China's Ministry of Commerce, I couldn't actually find any direct reference to rare earths at all in it. But I assumed that it was covered by the broader provisions that were contained in the agreement itself. Since then, more and more people have been pointing out that the Ministry of Commerce statement makes no mention, no reference to China relaxing any restrictions on exports of rare earths whatsoever. And, well, as some of you may remember, a couple of days ago, I pointed out that the Chinese Foreign Ministry had reacted very sharply when the US Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said that China had agreed to suspend its new regulations on exports of rare earths for 1 year. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman made statements which were then widely republished in the Chinese media, which all but called Scott Bessent a liar. Now, the Americans are saying that the Chinese have agreed to suspend for a year the operation of the rare earths regulations, the new rare earths export regulations. I had assumed that some Chinese official had confirmed this, but I have found no such confirmation at all. Now, it may be that I am missing something. I often am. But I haven't seen anything about this at all. As I said in my program yesterday, the Chinese readout of the meeting between Donald Trump and Xi Jinping makes no mention of rare earths at all. So could it be, just now throwing the idea into the open, that the Chinese have told the United States that they're not going to relax or change their rare earths regulations at all, that they remain in effect, but that China does not anticipate enforcing them for a period of 1 year, which would be close to what the Americans are saying, but not exactly the same as what the Americans are saying. Just say. Anyway, I ought to say that the agreement to relax, or rather to do away with the 50% rule for 1 year, given what has happened, I think it must be highly unlikely that the United States is going to reimpose that 50% rule anytime soon, at least not whilst China has the massive advantage in which it is now in through its monopoly export controls of rare earths and the various other trade tools that China also has. Anyway, then Arnold Bertrand goes on to say this: the United States will drop its overall tariffs on China to 47%, meaning that China now benefits from 16% tariffs as part of the Liberation Day tariff policy. Now, I think what Arnold Bertrand is saying here is controversial, but I think he is right. But anyway, this is what he says. Trump will mention the overall number to make it sound like he didn't cave on his Liberation Day tariffs. But when one looks into the details, China actually negotiated him down to approximately 16% on the Liberation Day tariffs, the extra 34% tariffs that he imposed on China over and above the tariffs that were already in existence at that time. So they're now down from 34% to 16%. That was what they were initially going to be, 34% in April, and of course way down from the 125% peak that they hit in the early summer when China began to take retaliatory trade measures. And in addition, Arnold Bertrand says the Chinese also got the so-called fentanyl tariff cut by half on top of that. And then Bertrand explains it: tariffs on Chinese goods were already standing at a weighted average of 20.7% before Trump took office. After taking office in February and March, before Liberation Day, Trump added 20% on top of that in the form of fentanyl tariffs. So before Liberation Day, the overall tariff on China was already 40.7%. On Liberation Day, Trump added a 34% tariff on top of the 40.7%, bringing total tariffs up to 74.7% overall. And then Bertrand continues, the fact that the overall rate is now down to 47%, given the fact that the deal includes a 50% reduction on the fentanyl tariffs, means that China has now negotiated the Liberation Day tariffs down to 16%, And that means that we now have 20.7%, which is the tariffs that China was already paying before Trump took office. 10% plus 10% for fentanyl, plus 16% Liberation Day tariffs. So a very sharp reduction. It's gone down, in other words, from 74.7% on Liberation Day to just 47% now. And then next, the United States will suspend its hostile actions on China's ships and shipbuilding industry, in exchange for which China will also suspend its retaliatory measures. This was the fees that the United States imposed on Chinese-built ships that docked in American ports. To stress again, these ships did not have to be owned or operated by Chinese ship owners or employ Chinese crews. The mere fact that they were built in China meant that they attracted higher harbor fees. The United States has had to cancel those for a year. But again, one wonders whether they will ever return. And then other parts of the deal, TikTok, China says, and I saw this in the Ministry of Commerce statement, that it agrees to properly resolve the TikTok issue, which is probably diplomatic speak to say that it's not resolved yet. Now, this is important because Donald Trump and the administration and commentary in the United States has been claiming for several months now that the whole business of TikTok is done and dusted. There's been no such confirmation from China. And the Chinese, in the Ministry of Commerce statement, are in effect saying that actually nothing has been agreed between China and the United States about TikTok, and that they do expect discussions to take place between China and the United States finally to resolve this issue about TikTok. And then, as Arnaud Bertrand points out, that soybeans, China does indeed agree to buy more soybeans. There's obviously the fentanyl cooperation, which I don't suspect will amount to very much, and handling of individual enterprise cases. And Arnaud Bertrand points out that this is a pretty opaque language. This is from the Chinese Ministry of Commerce, that suggests both sides discussed how to handle specific company issues, NVIDIA, Huawei, Nexperia, and that they reached consensus on this. My own view is that that's just flannel. I don't think it actually means very much at all. And then Bertrand continues that by mentioning that, by comparing the deal that's been done this time with the phase one deal that the Trump administration was able to negotiate with China over the course of Trump's first term. And he points out how much more favorable that phase one deal was to the United States. And he also, in this same post, references that same comment that I also referenced in my program yesterday, made by Xi Jinping to Donald Trump and repeated in the Chinese readout of the meeting between him and Donald Trump, in which Xi Jinping, well, apparently on one occasion he called China a giant ship going through winds, US-China relations going through winds, waves, and challenges, and all that. But also, China, the great ocean, the giant ocean, its economy as vast as an ocean, resilient and capable of meeting any challenges. Well, there it is. I mean, I cannot see this whole meeting between Trump and Xi as anything other than a defeat for Trump, and perhaps in some respects, a humiliation of Trump. It explains the body language, the icy body language of Xi Jinping, who had come basically to make sure that Trump agreed to what had been conceded and that it was all set down in writing. And Trump engaging in his usual, well, horsing around a little, perhaps doing so almost to an excessive degree, unusually extreme degree on this occasion. He lost, and he knows it, and his strange behaviour, well, perhaps not so strange for Donald Trump, but his behaviour underlines the fact. Now, I mentioned in my programme yesterday that there is no sign at all that the Chinese made any concessions about relations with Russia to the United States whatsoever. Even Trump himself has been forced to admit that the United States barely touched on the question of China's buying of Russian oil. There's now been an announcement in Beijing that the Russian Foreign Minister, Mikhail Mishustin, is coming to China. And the Russian Foreign Ministry has confirmed the same. On November 3rd to 4th, the head of government of the Russian Federation, Mikhail Mishustin, will visit the People's Republic of China in the city of Hangzhou, a 30th regular meeting between the heads of government of Russia and China is planned, with the participation of Mikhail Mishustin and Chinese State Council Premier Li Qiang. In Beijing, Mikhail Mishustin will meet the chairman of the People's Republic of China, Xi Jinping. So we're then told, and this is from TASS, I'm taking this from TASS, it discusses how there's going to be intense cooperation between the two countries, and it references strategic partnership in the energy sphere continues to expand. Russia is in first place in all supplies to China's market, and this year secured the lead in natural gas supplies due to the power of Siberia gas pipeline reaching its contracted output. Agreements have been achieved on building the Power of Siberia 2 gas pipeline, which will become one of the largest gas projects in history. The implementation of joint peaceful nuclear projects is underway, which might be a hint, by the way, that China is indeed going to get access to the new technology that Russia has demonstrated in the Burevestnik and Poseidon cruise missile and drones. The new miniature reactors that the Russians have produced, which baffle me and seem to baffle much of the world, but which do indisputably exist, marking, as I have said, as far as I can see, a major technological breakthrough. Putin spoke at length about how this technology has potential peaceful applications, which it obviously does, and well, China no doubt will soon gain access to it. And it doesn't seem, as I said, as if all of the brave talk from President Trump about getting China to distance itself from Russia, about China reducing its purchases of Russian oil, it doesn't seem as if any of that was true. And we now have more reports from Reuters, from India. Indian Oil Corporation, the country's top refiner, has bought 5 cargoes of Russian oil for December. The total volume of these cargoes amounts to 3.5 million barrels. Well, of course, there might be other imports as well. Who knows? It doesn't look as if India is stopping buying Russian oil. And TASS tells us that India and Russia, this is on today in TASS, have discussed issues of interaction in the sphere of military technical cooperation across all service branches of the armed forces, as well as prospects for joint research and development work. The Defence Production Department of the Indian Defence Ministry has reported following the 23rd meeting of the working group of the Russian-Indian Intergovernmental Commission on Military Technical Cooperation. The meeting was held in Moscow under the co-chairmanship of Deputy Head of the Indian Military Department, Sanjeev Kumar, and the First Deputy Director of Russia's Federal Service for Military Technical Cooperation, Andrei Boytsov. Discussions were held on issues related to military technical cooperation between the three branches of the armed forces, as well as research and development, the Indian Defence Ministry emphasised. A protocol was signed following the meeting, outlining the directions of a further interaction, as well as further measures to strengthen partnership and mutually develop the defence industries of the two countries. Now, Larry Johnson, on Sonar 21, his invaluable blog, has been pointing out that he has been in Moscow and he's been having meetings with all sorts of extremely important people in Moscow. Very important indeed, just saying. And he mentions how pretty much everybody that he's been speaking to has tried to make the same point, which is that the West overestimates the significance for the Russian economy of overseas trade. Russia is self-sufficient in raw materials, in food, and in energy. That already makes it a very, very difficult country to sanction. Russia does depend on imports of certain types of manufactured goods, but the days when it relied on manufactured goods, imports of manufactured goods, which it paid for in exports of raw materials, are in the past. In certain spheres of high technology, it does still have to import goods from some countries, though Russia itself, as it has demonstrated with the development of these two nuclear reactors, these miniature nuclear reactors, is itself a very advanced high technology country. The whole premise upon which sanctions have been developed against Russia over the last 3 years, that it is a one-dimensional economy, a gas station masquerading as a country, is wrong. And the further premise upon which the United States, Lindsey Graham and his people have been talking about this, the European Union also, the entire premise upon which they are working, which is that Russia depends for its economic survival, or indeed its ability to finance the special military operation on oil exports, is wrong too. Oil receipts from the oil industry do still account for 25% of the central government's budget, but that proportion is steadily falling. And were it to fall further, the Russian government has the fiscal space to compensate for it through other means, by, for example, increasing payroll taxes, and not, by the way, by so very much. Payroll taxes in Russia are very low, or by borrowing on Russian financial markets, which it has repeatedly shown that it is able to do. So, this whole premise, as I said, is based on a complete misjudgment of the realities of the Russian economy. But as we can see, despite the Lukoil Rosneft tariff that the United States announced a week ago, the claims that the Chinese and Indian governments were turning their backs on Moscow were wrong. I'm afraid there is something else about this affair, this whole affair between China and the United States. And that is that, again, the United States is saying things, is making claims about things that the other side supposedly agreed to, which are just not true. We've had Donald Trump's claims that he brokered a ceasefire between India and Pakistan, and I am now absolutely certain that that did not happen. Pakistan asked India for a ceasefire because the balance of the war, of the fighting, was starting to turn against it. India agreed. Trump had a marginal role. Trump has claimed that over a course of a telephone call with Modi, which never took place, Modi gave him an assurance, which he never did, that India would stop buying Russian oil. We can see that India is continuing to buy Russian oil. And we've had claims that China has made concessions, which it doesn't appear from Arnaud Bertrand's account that it has done. Even Trump's announcement that he is going to China in April needs to be treated with great care, because to repeat again, if you look at the Chinese readout of the meeting between Trump and Xi Jinping, it turns out that Trump basically invited himself to China in April. He has not yet had an agreement from the Chinese to host him in April, or indeed any time next year at all. One could go back and discuss the telephone conversation between Putin and Trump that took place 3 weeks ago. Trump rushed out a statement on Truth Social claiming that he had agreed, that he and Putin had agreed to meet in Budapest. The Russian readouts, comments and briefings said no such thing. The Russians, on the contrary, said that though they were open to a meeting in Budapest, this time, unlike the meeting in Alaska, it needed to be very, very carefully prepared. Eventually, when it became clear that the Russians were asking questions and demanding answers, which Trump did not want to give, Trump called the meeting off. Again, it seems to me, he claimed that the Russians had agreed to something which they had never done. Now, foreign policy cannot be conducted in this way. Prime Minister Modi is already avoiding meetings with Donald Trump. Everybody has noticed the icy demeanour of Xi Jinping at the meeting in South Korea with Donald Trump also. And, well, I discuss in many programmes now the damage that all of these interactions with the Russians have done in Moscow, and how Putin recently gave a conference in which he conspicuously avoided mentioning Donald Trump by name. This has to stop. If leaders cannot trust the President of the United States and his officials in conversation, diplomacy simply cannot take place. Now, we have another example of this this morning. We have something which, again, obviously originates from within the United States government. We've had a bogus story in the Financial Times from a few days ago, a few weeks ago, that Putin bored Trump with a long lecture about the history of the conflict in Ukraine at their meeting in Alaska, and that Trump became so enraged that he almost walked out of the meeting and he called the entire meeting short. He cut the whole meeting short. And I've already explained that this is obviously wrong. It bears no relationship to what Trump himself said about the meeting in Alaska at the time. He said it was a 10 out of 10 meeting, in fact, as I now recall. And anyway, the Russians have themselves provided their far more plausible, in fact, undoubtedly correct account of what actually took place in Alaska, which is that what Putin wanted to talk about when he met with Trump was not the history of the conflict, important though that is, but the offer that Witkoff brought with him to Moscow, and which Putin, perhaps alone within the Russian leadership, was minded to accept. And Putin went through that offer step by step, clause by clause, paragraph by paragraph, over the course of the meeting with Trump, asking Witkoff, who was sitting next to Trump, whether he'd understood the proposal correctly, and Witkoff said that he did, and then Putin said that he was, on that basis, prepared to work with it and to move forward with it. There is a brilliant discussion of this meeting in Alaska and of this whole disastrous episode provided by Kautilya the Contemplator on his Substack blog. And its title, for those who want to find it, is The Collapse of American Diplomacy from Strategic Statecraft to Political Spectacle. And over the course of this article, Kautilya the Contemplator goes through the whole ghastly affair step by step and points out, borrowing a phrase from Lavrov, that what has happened since Alaska is that Moscow has been waiting for an American response to an American proposal, to the proposal that Witkoff presented to Putin in August. And as Kautilya correctly says, this captures the tragicomic collapse of coherence at the heart of US diplomacy. This absence of clarity is even more astonishing, considering that Trump has reversed his position from declaring in Alaska that a broader peace agreement, not a ceasefire, was required to end the conflict, to now demanding a complete ceasefire all over again. And he says these developments are all more than an embarrassment. They signal institutional disintegration. And I think this is absolutely correct. The article, by the way, really does deserve reading because it dissects and explains what has happened. Well, as far as I can see, better than anyone has done, and more thoroughly too. And perhaps, if I could say, it gives an Asian perspective to the whole affair, which, given that we are looking at the rise of Asia, is perhaps particularly important. Just saying. Anyway, the point is that Lavrov has now set it all out. He's now provided a clear explanation of what happened in Alaska, of what happened since, of why the Budapest summit has not happened, which is that the United States is unable to move forward with its own proposal. The Financial Times, however, in an article published today, which is clearly sourced from officials within the US government, would have us accept a different story. Supposedly, what caused the United States to call off the summit meeting in Budapest was a tough memorandum from the Russian Foreign Ministry and a tense telephone conversation between Lavrov and Rubio. And what did that tough memorandum from the Russian Foreign Ministry that supposedly caused all the trouble, what did it actually say? Well, according to the Financial Times, the memo sent to Washington underlined the same demands to address what Putin calls the root causes of his 3.5-year invasion. These include territorial concessions, a steep reduction of Ukraine's armed forces, and guarantees it will never join NATO. In other words, the long-standing and well-known Russian demands, the demands that they have set out time and again, which they laid out at the meeting in the Foreign Ministry on the 14th of June 2024, that they have repeated at various times since. And the demands which the proposal Witkoff brought with him to Moscow was supposed to address. Putin, over the course of the brief press conference that took place in Alaska, said clearly that the way forward was to address the root causes of the conflict. And the President of the United States, Donald Trump, was sitting next to him, giving every indication of agreement. So, I don't know what this Russian memo said, given that the United States has recently invented a telephone conversation between Prime Minister Modi of India and the President of the United States, which never happened. Perhaps this memo doesn't even exist. I assume it does exist, and I assume that it did, of course, clarify again Russia's long-standing proposals. But going back to what Lavrov is saying, what Lavrov has disclosed, the Russians, probably in that memorandum, were again asking the Americans for their response, for, as Lavrov puts it, and Katilia also puts it, the American response to America's own proposal. The Financial Times article is, well, unique in that it does imply, to some extent, it does reference slightly the fact that Lavrov has in fact been making certain comments about the diplomacy and the diplomatic action. But it completely misrepresents them. It says this, it says that in an interview with a Hungarian YouTube channel on Sunday, Lavrov said Putin had told in Alaska that Russia would agree to US peace proposals, but no direct answer followed. Full stop. Though Trump did endorse Putin's call for a comprehensive peace deal, the United States has since reverted to demanding an immediate ceasefire. Well, yes, all that is true. But this doesn't say that Lavrov also said that Witkoff, Trump's envoy, came to Moscow with a fully thought out proposal, which Putin went over with Witkoff and Trump in Alaska and said that he accepted. Anyway, I'm speechless that all of this is taking place. But to repeat again, this is not how diplomacy should be conducted. We see, as I said, that Narendra Modi is now avoiding meetings with the President of the United States. We see that the Chinese President has not only had a discussion with the President of the United States, which was clearly icy, but that it resulted in an agreement in which China straightforwardly wiped the floor and apparently had every intention of doing so because of the total collapse of goodwill. The same is going to happen before very long with the Russians. Now, this now brings me back to the topic of the war, because again, the Financial Times, as it always does, downplays the importance of events on the Ukrainian battlefields. It says this in the same article: Russian forces have entered Kupiansk in recent days. Not true. Anybody who's following the war closely will know that they have been fighting inside Kupiansk for weeks. And then the Financial Times says, Zelensky on Wednesday says that the situation remains difficult, but claims Ukrainian forces have managed to gain more control and are vowing to continue to defend their positions. I know of nobody who believes that in the Kupiansk area, the Ukrainians have made any substantive gains, except those who take their views, their understanding of the conflict from Zelensky himself. And because Zelensky says something, that doesn't make it true. Every observer of the situation in Kupiansk, Russian, Ukrainian, Western, who has any awareness of what is actually happening there, knows that the reality is far worse than the Financial Times is saying. And that the Financial Times goes on to say, the foothold on the western side of the Oskol River gives Russian forces another launch pad from which to attack the remaining part of Donbass region. It's not just a foothold. We're not even talking about a bridgehead anymore. That was perhaps a legitimate way to describe it a year ago when the Russians first crossed the Oskol River. But they are now well positioned far beyond it. Just saying. Again, it doesn't do any good to pretend these things or to continue to repeat these fairy tales that Zelensky and his officials in Kiev are still generating. Anyway, that now brings me to the realities on the front lines. And here I will say that, entirely unsurprisingly, President Zelensky has, and his government, have rejected the Russian proposals that journalists should visit the area of the cauldrons in Pokrovsk and Kupiansk, the proposal that President Putin made. I don't think anybody expected seriously that Zelensky would ever agree to this proposal. And by extension, by the way, they've also rejected ceasefires in this area. They have also rejected calls from sections of the Ukrainian military themselves. I've seen these on Telegram channels, that Pokrovsk itself be abandoned, that an order to withdraw from Pokrovsk be given. Zelensky has said over the last couple of hours that there's been a massively successful counterattack in northeast of Pokrovsk. He claims that Kucherov Yar and other villages have been recaptured by the Ukrainians. And he claims that the Ukrainians have taken 2,000 Russian prisoners. Well, that may or may not be true, but this morning I noticed that Radovka gives a completely different account of the fighting in northeast of Pokrovsk. It says that there had indeed been major Ukrainian counterattacks in precisely that area, but that the counterattacks were unsuccessful, that the pendulum has swung back in Russia's favour, and that the Russians are once again in control of the village of Kucherov Yar. Now, sometimes Radovka has been ahead of actual reports, actual events. It's reported things that have not always happened or have not yet happened. It has also sometimes been straightforwardly wrong. But mostly it has been reliable. And about the fighting in and around Pokrovsk, it has been especially reliable. Given a choice between whom I would believe, Radovka or Zelensky, well, it's no contest. I would believe Radovka every time. That's not to say, as I said, that they're always right. It's just that Zelensky is, to put it mildly, an unreliable narrator of these events. Anyway, what is the situation in Pokrovsk itself? Well, we've actually had quite a lot of video footage and reporting from inside the Pokrovsk cauldron. The area in Mirnograd and Pokrovsk and in the open fields between those two settlements, where the Ukrainians still have what might be called organized forces. I say that, I've no doubt that there are stragglers all over Pokrovsk, Ukrainian stragglers, and maybe even entire units, entirely cut off from each other and submerged in the flood of the Russian forces that have now moved into Pokrovsk. Fighting of that kind, no doubt, is continuing to take place, and mopping up operations, no doubt, are happening. But anyway, the fact that there are still stragglers, no doubt, holding out in Pokrovsk itself is of no significance. There is an area of territory, mostly in northeastern Pokrovsk and perhaps northeastern Mirnograd, where the Ukrainians still have what might be called organized forces. Anyway, these forces are cut off. There are further reports today of more Russian advances northwest of Pokrovsk in the open fields. I'm getting the impression that the Russians are now moving towards the village of Gryshino. They must be very, very close there. Gryshino is a village west of Pokrovsk, which is just north of the main road, the main supply road. That supply road, of course, has long been cut off. But the Ukrainians still control Gryshino. And there's been reports that the Ukrainians have been concentrating their various relief forces in Gryshino, the forces they use to try to break the siege of Pokrovsk itself. The Russians seem to be edging closer to Gryshino, and it may be that before long they will conduct an attack, a direct attack on those Ukrainian forces in Gryshino itself. Anyway, the Russians, as I said, are clearly north of Pokrovsk. There are still places in Pokrovsk itself, in northeastern Pokrovsk, north of the railway lines, that still fall inside this area of Ukrainian control that I have been talking about. But the Russians are shrinking this area all the time. And I have to say, my impression is that there isn't very much resistance from the Ukrainians anymore. They're not exactly surrendering. In fact, they're not surrendering, but they are holding ground. They're not holding ground. When the Russians come, apparently, they quickly retreat. And the same appears to be true in Mirnograd. There's now video footage showing the Russians in northern Mirnograd. And probably, again, the Ukrainians still control a stretch of Mirnograd, but I doubt that they control very much. And in the area between Mirnograd and Pokrovsk, there are a number of settlements. This is basically a continuous built-up area, but there, the settlements between Pokrovsk and Mirnograd are smaller and the buildings are lighter. They're probably dachas and residential buildings, one or two story residential buildings. Anyway, the point is that the Russians now are entering this territory as well. And it could be that before long, the cauldron in Pokrovsk that I've just been describing is going to be split into two or even three parts, maybe a third part in the south, where there are reports that the remnants of a Ukrainian brigade are now surrounded. A second part in northeast Pokrovsk and in the area just north of Pokrovsk. And a third area, northeast, in northeast Mirnograd and just outside Mirnograd too. When that happens, when the cauldron itself becomes fragmented and divided, subdivided into mini cauldrons, and I suspect we are probably days or hours or at most days from that point, then it is the end. I cannot imagine that in that kind of situation, resistance can continue for very long, and at that point we will probably see a collapse. There does not seem to be any route that the Ukrainian troops can use to escape. I don't know exactly what form the collapse will take, but I would be surprised if there aren't large numbers of people surrendering on this occasion. Because realistically, what else can they do? Now, in Kupiansk, it's more difficult to get a clear picture of what is going on. But the reports I discussed yesterday that the Russians have advanced further south on the west bank of the Oskol River appear to be true. And they appear to have gained control of all the potential remaining crossing points. And I understand that the condition of the Ukrainian troops in the industrial area of eastern Kupiansk, east of the Oskol River, is in some respects even worse than that of the soldiers who are surrounded in Pokrovsk. The inability of people in the West, at least the media in the West, to acknowledge this dreadful reality is startling, but there it is. These cauldrons indisputably exist, and they're arriving closer to their crisis point. Anyway, elsewhere, the Russians have now, as far as I can see, fairly practically sorted out all of the problems that they had on the Yanchur River in Zaporozhye region. I think I'm right in saying that the only important settlement that they have to capture there is Uspenivka. All of the others have now fallen under Russian control. The Ukrainians are going to have to retreat from Uspenivka before long, because if they don't, they will be surrounded there. And of course, given the way in which Zelensky and Syrsky run things, perhaps they will be given orders to stand and fight. But of course, in that case, we're just going to have another cauldron, a smaller one, this time in Uspenivka. I noticed that several people now are acknowledging that Siversk is now practically a cauldron as well, that the Russians are now very close to cutting the last remaining supply road into Siversk, which goes to Siversk from the southwest. And of course, the Russian Defense Ministry claims that there is street fighting going on in Siversk itself. None of the mapping projects acknowledge this, but everyone else, all of these mapping projects now, or at least the reputable ones, now put the Russians north, south, east of Siversk, very, very close to the town. Again, once the supplies are cut, there will be a concerted Russian attack on the town. And at that point, given that it's a relatively small place, even if it is located on a hill, there will be a sudden collapse there too. There is now universal acknowledgement that fighting is indeed taking place within Liman. And apparently the topography of the town, at least some are saying, make defence of Liman very difficult. And there is also continuing fighting in Konstantinovka, and the Russians continue to expand their positions there. Lastly, reports appeared this morning that in Dnipropetrovsk region, the Russians have broken in to the fortified town of Novopavlovka, which has been the main barrier that the Russians have faced in Dnipropetrovsk region to advance west. It looks as if the Russians have begun an operation to storm that town too. Over the last 2 weeks, there has been a major change in the situation on the Ukrainian battlefields. Since October 2023, the Russians have been on a continuous offensive. Throughout that time, however, except for a relatively brief period in the late summer of 2024, the Ukrainians have been resisting. The Russians have been advancing and gaining ground, including capturing fortified positions. But one could not say that Ukrainian resistance had totally collapsed. The Ukrainians were fighting and resisting, and it would take time for the Russians to capture places and for the Russians to move forward. There was one brief period, I remember, in the summer, when the Russian forces that were advancing west from Ocheretino and Avdeevka seemed to be able to capture villages one after the other against only very light Ukrainian resistance. But the Ukrainians eventually did establish a series of fortified positions around Kurakhovo, and they were able to restore or re-establish a front line there. Well, this time it is different. This time, over the last 3 weeks, it seems to me that Ukrainian resistance is weakening on every part of the front lines. The Russians are advancing now steadily in Volchansk, in Kharkiv. They've now entered Liman, and they're about to storm Siversk. I get the sense that the Russians are, the crisis in Kupiansk is deepening, and that the Russians are able to enlarge their areas of control there all the time. I've discussed the situation in Pokrovsk, and of course in Zaporozhye. and elsewhere. It's not yet the case that there is no Ukrainian resistance at all, but it is becoming weaker and more disorganized, a clear sign that the Ukrainians now lack infantry, as many people have been saying, and that the Russian policy of attrition is now having a decisive effect. Anyway, that's the situation in the war. I should say that there was more missile and drone strikes over the last couple of hours by the Russians, and the Russians have provided more information about the massive missile and drone strikes that they conducted across Ukraine recently. And I've noticed that various Western agencies are now talking with alarm about the fact that Ukraine is now facing basically an energy collapse in advance of what is looking like an increasingly cold winter. And again, previously, over the course of previous Russian aerial offensives, there was resistance. There was a Ukrainian air defense system that was functioning and which was shooting down at least some missiles and drones, even if never as many as Ukraine wanted to claim. But to be frank, I don't get the sense of an air defense system, an organized air defense system, now operating over Ukraine like that anymore. Well, maybe one shouldn't jump ahead. Maybe something will happen over the next few weeks and months that will pull everything together. I'm not sure what it's going to be. But anybody who is realistic will acknowledge a worse military crisis, Ukraine facing a worse military crisis than any one of those that it has faced up to now at any time. It is a much worse situation than the one which existed in February and March 2022, when the Russians were outside Kiev. The Russian forces in Kiev were not there in any great number. There were negotiations going on between the Russians and the Ukrainians, which on the Russian side appeared to be conducted in good faith. And help from the West was coming. It doesn't look to me to be like that this time anymore. There are now growing concerns that the West is not going to be able to continue to fund Ukraine beyond the spring. The 140 billion euro loan extracted from the Russian assets was the last throw of the dice, as far as I can see. And there are now increasing doubts about that also. And besides, money by itself is not going to be enough to address Ukraine's fundamental structural problems. But Zelensky is determined to fight on. General Sirsky has resurfaced. He's now on the front lines. He says that the situation in Pokrovsk is complicated and difficult, but it is untrue, apparently, to talk about an encirclement. Ukrainian soldiers and people like Berlinskaya and Bezuglaya and others might be talking about an encirclement in Pokrovsk, but Sirsky assures us that that has not happened, that has not happened, just as he assured us on the eve of the fall of Suja in Kursk region just a few weeks ago, back in March, that he had the situation there completely under control. Now, I spent a lot of time in this program talking about the way in which the Trump administration has been conducting diplomacy over the course of this year. It has already resulted in a massive debacle with China. I cannot see that any other word suffices to describe what has taken place. There's maybe a certain unwillingness to acknowledge the full extent of this in the media, but there is no doubt that the US did not come out well from the meeting with China. And even the BBC, I noticed, had this to say about the negotiations with China. Trump expected the tariffs would balance the trade deficit with China, and restrictions on advanced chips would curb the technological development of the US's main economic and military rival. None of the fundamental issues for which Trump started the trade war were resolved at the meeting in South Korea. China simply raised the stakes, limiting exports of rare earth metals and magnets, without which Western car plants and the defense industry would grind to a halt. At the same time, China stopped buying soybeans from the United States, driving American farmers to the brink of bankruptcy. Well, we've seen a debacle with China. The United States went into the game thinking it had stronger cards to play than it really did. We're seeing exactly the same happen with Russia. The United States tried to negotiate. Well, it didn't try to negotiate. It tried to impose its own ideas for a freeze on Russia, assuming that it had more cards to play with the Russians than it really did. And we see how the United States has made claims also about ceasefires in Gaza, which frankly are increasingly looking like they have no real substance either. And of an Israeli victory there, by the way, which bear no connection to reality. I'm going to suggest this. At this present time, difficult to imagine that the relationship with Russia can be repaired anytime soon. A Russian member of the Duran community forwarded to me some comments by a Russian official about the United States, which were unprecedentedly aggressive. I cannot imagine, if all of these cities fall soon, which they will, that the United States will find that the Russians are going to be willing to simply go back to the proposal that Witkoff made in Alaska. I think that the political maneuver space for Putin to agree to that at that point will have gone. And besides, even he by now must have little trust. So, we are, or so seems to me, now in a situation where the United States has spoiled its relationships with the other two great powers, China and Russia, in a way that they no longer trust it anymore. And it has probably done massive damage to its relationship with India, which is another great power. The United States needs to take a step back, think about where it actually is, rethink the way it conducts its foreign policy, and conduct foreign policy again in a more conventional way. Going back to Kautilya, the contemplator, he points out how much more structured US foreign policy at one time used to be, how there used to be disciplined preparation. During the Cold War, meetings between American and Soviet leaders were preceded by methodical back-channeling, shuttle diplomacy, and tightly sequenced drafts so that leaders arrived to ratify, not improvise. Today's ad hoc approach reduces summitry to theatre. And this is absolutely correct. And as Cartelia rightly says, it creates chaos and incoherence. And as we've just seen in South Korea, and we'll shortly see over Ukraine, the result is absolutely against the best interests of the United States. Will the United States return to more conventional, traditional diplomacy as it once knew how to conduct? I don't think so. In which case, things can only get worse. And given how bad they already are, I shudder to think what worse in this context will mean. Anyway, this is where I finish today's programme. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.